Now, the last time we talked about how proteins get into the various parts of the endomembrane system, in particularly into lysosomes. And today I want to talk first about how proteins get into organelles that are not considered part of the endomembrane system, that is, peroxisomes and mitochondria. And what we say about mitochondria in animal cells also goes for chloroplasts as well in plant cells. And then when we finish that, I want to start talking about signaling. And we'll get as far as we can today, and we'll pick the story up again after break. Now, none of what I'm going to say today is on the exam, but we are going to refer to lysosomes, so if you happen to have bothered to come, you're going to probably get a little review, which can't hurt. Now, in fact, if you look at the table that you have on handout 14C, what we've done here is to compare some of the properties of lysosomes, peroxisomes, and mitochondria, because it seems to be easier to keep it all straight if you keep the comparison in mind. Now, we haven't talked that much about peroxisomes, so we're going to talk both about their function and about how they get things inside. Now, if you look at the bottom, you notice the first column, it says for comparisons of peroxisomes to lysosomes and mitochondria. If you compare peroxisomes and lysosomes, there are actually a lot of similarities. So you can see that peroxisomes and lysosomes both have a single membrane around them. That, of course, is in contrast to mitochondria and chloroplasts, which have a double membrane. They don't have any DNA, which again is in contrast to mitochondria, which do. And both lysosomes and peroxisomes are about the same density and the same size. And both of them sequester dangerous stuff. Lysosomes contain enzymes which can break things down. Peroxisomes contain enzymes which generate peroxide, which is very reactive. So in both cases, it's a good idea to keep either the enzymes and or their products separate from the rest of the cell, and that makes sense. Now, for some time, people were not really sure whether we really had here two sets of organelles or one organelle. Because it seemed reasonable that maybe you had one organelle that had all the nasties in it, and both the degradation enzymes we now know are in the lysosomes, and the catalases and peroxidases we now know are in peroxisomes, maybe they were all in one set of vesicles. And where does this confusion or question come from? It comes from the fact that these two organelles are difficult to separate biochemically because they are the same size and the same density. Density is determined by the ratio of lipid to protein, and they have about the same proportions, and they're about the same size. So if you break the cell open and you separate the organelles, these two are not separable. Now, how would you go about trying to do it? When you separate things on the basis of size or density, you would normally use a centrifuge. But remember, there are two different methods we talked about. There's sedimentation velocity and equilibrium density centrifugation. And in sedimentation velocity, you see how fast things are moved through a test tube as a result of the force of centrifugation. And so sedimentation velocity depends on size. Of course, also on shape. But these are about the same size and shape, so they move the same distance. Now, density equilibrium density centrifugation is the kind that was used in the Meselson-Stahl experiment, where basically you float things in a gradient, and they end up matching, they localize in the gradient where their density matches the surrounding solution. Well, both of these organelles have the same density, so they float in the same place. So biochemically, straightforwardly, you can't separate them. But then somebody had a really good idea, which is he took some rats and he fed them Triton. Triton is a detergent, and this may sound pretty terrible, but if you've ever looked at, say, Angel Food Cake Mix, it's full of detergent. So a lot of these things are. This is actually a sort of fake lipid, and that it's an amphipathic molecule that has a hydrophobic end and a hydrophilic end, and apparently a little of it doesn't do anything. But when rats eat it, it accumulates in lysosomes. They take it in by endocytosis, and it ends up in the lysosome. It does not end up in the peroxisome. So as a result, the peroxisome has the normal ratio of lipid to protein and the normal density. But this, the lysosome now has lots of extra triton, which acts like lipid. So essentially, it has more lipid for the same amount of protein, so it's lighter. That is, it has a lower density, and now you can take the rats, sacrifice them, take out their livers, and you can, from those cells, separate lysosomes and peroxisomes. And when you separate these two organelles, you can now break them open and measure what enzymes are inside, and it becomes very clear that they are two different kinds of organelles with two different sets of enzymes. Now, you could have got this another way. We talked before about how do you tell which part of the cell has what enzymatic activity. And one method is a variation of what we've just said, a biochemical method or a grind and find method, where you take cells, you break them open, and you separate the various parts, and then you characterize the various parts. So this is the biochemical approach. But there's also the cell biology approach, or in situ assays. And the idea here is that you have intact cells, but as you may remember, you provide a substrate which precipitates when formed into product. And so if you were to provide a substrate for a lysosomal enzyme, such as acid phosphatase, which is perhaps its most famous marker enzyme. It takes off phosphates at acid pH optimum. If you provide a substrate that makes a precipitable product, that product will be found associated with one set of vesicles in the cell. But not all of them. On the other hand, if you add a substrate for a classic enzyme of peroxisomes, if you add a substrate for either catalase or peroxidase, which forms a precipitable product, then that precipitable product will be associated with a different set of vesicles in the cell. So that's another way of showing that when you look at the cell in place, the position of these enzymes is in one set of vesicles, and the acid hydrolases are in a different set of vesicles. So one way or the other, it becomes quite clear with these two complementary methods that lysosomes and peroxisomes are actually two different sets of vesicles. So, having said that then, what do peroxisomes do? We know what lysosomes do. They have the acid hydrolases for breaking down and recycling macromolecules. But what do peroxisomes do? And actually what peroxisomes do is quite variable. But in animal cells, their primary function is probably detoxification. Although they do other things as well. So they contain oxidases. And they catalyze the reaction RH2 plus oxygen gives you R plus peroxide, which is H2O2. Now, this can be any reduced compound. Not any, but anything there is an enzyme for. And this is its oxidized version. Now, you should realize that this is a real oxidation. When we talked about energy metabolism, when Dr. Chazen talked about glycolysis or oxidative force or the Krebs cycle, all those oxidations were really dehydrogenations. The way you oxidize something is you took hydrogen off, but you didn't give it to oxygen. You put it on some carrier, or you sent it only in the very last step of oxidative of electron transport do you actually use oxygen. But these are real oxidases that require oxygen, and the hydrogen is given to oxygen, and you get peroxide. This is the dangerous stuff, because this reacts with all kinds of things and oxidizes them. Now, why is this a detoxification? For many compounds, the oxidized form is much less toxic than the reduced form, just straight away. But the other reason that this makes such a difference is that this is likely to be more water-soluble, less hydrogen, less hydrophobic. And things that are more water-soluble are much more easily removed from the body. There has to be a carrier to get them out of the cell. But once they get out of the cell, they get into the extracellular fluid. They can be carried by the blood, passed into the filtrate, and excreted in the urine. So water-soluble things can be washed out. Lipid-soluble things tend to lodge in membranes and stay. And that's why things like vitamin A and vitamin D, which are absolutely essential, but if you have too much of them, they accumulate. If you take too much vitamin C, which it can't hurt you because you just excrete it in your urine. So it's not clear that megadoses of vitamin C are good for you, but they're not going to do you any harm. But megadoses of vitamin D or vitamin A can cause harm because those compounds accumulate. They are lipid-soluble vitamins. So we have detoxified the compound, but we've got ourselves peroxide, and that is not good news. So catalase, they're assorted oxidases in the in the peroxisomes that carry out or catalyze the first reaction. But what catalase catalyzes is peroxide plus another reduced compound gives you back the oxidized version of the reduced compound and water. Now, this compound here that I've written is R'H2 could be another toxic reduced compound which you wish to make more soluble or less toxic. But it could also be another molecule of peroxide. And that note that is also written, so it just could be 2H2O2. So if this is H2O2, R prime is just O2. In this case, you're just using two molecules of peroxide. Now, notice what happens. The two molecules of peroxide, you end up with water, which you know how to get rid of, and you end up with oxygen. So now that oxygen can be used in further oxidation reactions to drive oxidases. So you have regenerated some of the oxygen. Okay. So this is one of the major jobs of peroxisomes is to detoxify things and to sequester and get rid of peroxide to remove the peroxide before it can do any damage. Now, how do these enzymes get into peroxisomes? We know how enzymes get into lysosomes, but how do enzymes get into peroxisomes? Now, peroxisomes have a bilayer, a lipid protein bilayer, and then they have enzymes in the matrix. These oxidases and catalases are in the matrix. Now, peroxisomes are not considered part of the endomembrane system because all of these soluble enzymes in the matrix come from synthesis on free ribosomes in the cytoplasm. So catalase, etc., the enzymes are made on free ribosomes. Remember we said that you have a ribosome making a protein, If that protein has a signal peptide, then those ribosomes will attach to the ER, and the proteins will enter the ER as they are made co-translationally. But if there is no signal peptide, then the ribosomes will stay in the cytoplasm and make the protein, and the protein will be released. And if that protein has to go into an organelle, it will go into the organelle after it's made. So instead of import being at the same time, it's later. And this is called post-translational import. Now, as you might imagine, this requires energy. In the case of co-translational import, the energy of protein synthesis and needed to move the message versus the ribosomes, there's enough left over to push the protein in. But here, the protein has to go across the membrane, and so that requires energy. Exactly how things get into peroxisomes is not really understood, because it seems that at least some of them don't unfold. And how big proteins get across without unfolding isn't known. It's assumed that there is some kind of channel protein, something pore-like in the membrane, but nobody knows exactly how it works. Now, what would determine whether a protein stays in the cytoplasm, say, goes to a mitochondrion, or goes to a peroxisome? That's going to be encoded in the protein itself. There's going to be some stretch of amino acids or some patch on the folded protein which binds to the right receptor and gets it to the right place. So there are different localization signals for peroxisomal enzymes, mitochondrial and mitochondrial enzymes. But what about an enzyme that just stays in the cytoplasm? It doesn't have any nuclear localization signals at all, any localization signals at all. If it has a nuclear localization signal, it'll go into the nucleus. Now, what is a peroxisomal localization signal like? There's actually more than one that we know about. But most of them are thought to have their signal on their carboxyl end. So the peroxisomal localization signal, at least some of the time, is on the carboxyl end. Now, how is this different from a signal peptide? A signal peptide that says, take me to the ER, is usually on the amino end, or it's the first transmembrane section. But this is on the very far end. Now, that makes sense because when do you need to read the signal that says, take me to a peroxisome? While the protein is being made or after it's finished? You finish it first and then you move it to a peroxisome. So it's okay to have the signal at the far end because you'll be able to read it in time. But remember that when a protein enters the endomembrane system, it does that as it's made. So you have to recognize the take me to the ER signal long before the protein is finished. And so it makes sense that the localization signal for the endomembrane system is somewhere here down on the amino end where it's first made. Now, what about the membrane here? It's not clear entirely how the proteins of the membrane get here. It is conceivable that they are made on the ER, but we're not sure. What we do know is that the proteins of the membrane and the proteins of the matrix get there separately. And the one other thing worth mentioning is what about the lipids that make up the membrane? Some of the lipids are actually made in the organelle itself, and some of them seem to be made on the surface of the ER and transported over here to the membrane. Now, the way we've discussed it, lipids are made on the surface of the ER and inserted into the ER membrane. And then how do they get somewhere else?
Through
by a vesicle budding off carrying a patch of membrane. But it's also true that there are transport proteins that seem to be able to bind lipid out of one membrane, carry it somewhere else, and insert it into another membrane. So we haven't talked about them at all. But there are some such proteins, and they are thought to ferry lipid, probably at least some of it, to peroxisomes and to mitochondria. So some of the lipids made here, some of the lipid is made elsewhere, and transported. Now, how do you get more peroxisomes? If you have a cell that's growing, where do the new peroxisomes come from? We think that new lysosomes come from making a new package of lysosomal enzymes and fusing that with a package of substrate. But it's thought that for peroxisomes, the way you get more of them is they get bigger, they get so big that they divide in half. So even though they have no DNA, they don't normally form from scratch de novo, but they're thought to grow and divide. It's possible under some conditions they are made de novo. So however you get more proteins, whether they fill a new peroxisome or they add to a pre-existing peroxisome, the proteins are going to come from free ribosomes, not from ribosomes attached to the ER. That is, all the proteins of the matrix. Now, how does this compare to what goes on with mitochondria? So first let me ask, are there questions about peroxisomes? Yeah? I don't understand your question. You're saying that the enzymes of lysosomes are inserted co-translationally into the ER, not into the lysosome. But they are inserted into the endomembrane system co-translationally. The enzymes of the matrix of the peroxisome are inserted from free ribosomes after the protein is finished. Does that answer your question? Yes. Yeah.
Can they fold up in the cytoplasm?
Do the proteins fold up first in the cytoplasm and then enter, or do they remain unfolded and then wiggle across? That is the question. There's some indication that the proteins, well, let me just say that anytime you fold a protein, you need a chaperone, and there's chaperones involved here, though we're not talking about it. But it's thought that at least some of these proteins of the peroxisome fold first, and then are carried across the membrane in folded form, although it's not clear how that could happen. Yeah? What's to stop them from having enzymatic activity in the cytoplasm? Well, it could be that they are bound to other proteins which inhibit them, or it could be they're not absolutely completely folded, or it could be that they can't get their hands on substrate. Yeah.
Just to repeat, the proteins in the peroxisome membrane, did you say we don't know where they
are? We're not quite totally sure where the proteins in this membrane come from. Or whether they always come from the same place, even. Yeah?
Even though localization signals are tend to be on the end, if there is a problem with folding or something, could that then affect whether it gets to where it goes if there's a problem with the way it's...
If there is a problem with... The question is, could a problem with folding cause a localization signal to be misread? I suppose it could. But remember that most things that don't fold properly get detected and sent to proteasomes. Okay. So, one more. Yeah.
Is there any further modification that happens to peroxisome enzymes once they enter the organelle?
Is there any modification that occurs to peroxisomal enzymes once they enter the organelle? Well, they might bind, some of them might bind to cofactors there instead of in the cytoplasm. But I don't know. There's no class of things like glycosylation that are associated with peroxisomes that I know of. Okay. So now, what about mitochondria? Well, as we've already mentioned, mitochondria don't have a single membrane. They have a double membrane. Chloroplasts are similar. Actually, they have three. And it's thought, as we've explained before, that these are the descendants of once free-living bacteria, and that this is a remnant. The inner mitochondrial membrane is a remnant of the bacterial membrane, and the outer mitochondrial membrane is what engulfed it, is sort of more related to a eukaryotic membrane. So they do contain DNA. They don't contain very much, but they do contain DNA. And I'm looking now at the table on the top of your handout. Now, do they grow and split? And the answer is yes. Not surprisingly, the way you get more mitochondria is you double the DNA, you double the contents, and you divide it up so that each daughter mitochondrion gets a copy of the DNA. Now, where are the proteins made that end up in a mitochondrion? This turns out to be complex because some of the proteins of a mitochondrion are made inside in the matrix, but most of the proteins of a mitochondrion or a chloroplast are made outside on free ribosomes and then enter post-translationally. So most of the proteins are made first on free ribosomes and then they have to enter the mitochondria. Now, how is that done? Now, maybe before we say that, we should say, what do they make themselves? Mitochondria don't have very much DNA, but if they're going to use that DNA at all, they have to have DNA polymerase to replicate it, RNA polymerase, ribosomes, transfer RNA, etc. And they have all that stuff. They have all the equipment needed for transcription, translation, and replication. Now, most of that stuff is made outside. But the ribosomal RNA itself and the transfer RNA is made inside, and a few proteins. The proteins in chloroplasts do the same but make more proteins, but still, even there, most of them come from the outside. Now, the proteins that are made inside are thought to be the very hydrophobic ones whose transport would be an issue. But any protein that can be made outside and imported in, the ability to make that protein has been lost. Now, you know from last semester that mitochondria carry out electron transport and oxidative phosphorylation, and most of the components of that are complicated enzymes with multiple subunits. And for many of those enzymes or carriers, one subunit is made in the mitochondrion, and all the other subunits come from the cytoplasm. So how do the proteins that have to enter get inside? Now, it's known that there are translocases. There are channels of some sort similar to translocons in both the inner and the outer membrane. Now, if we blow it up properly, remember that each membrane is a bilayer. So let's say this is the outer one. We've just blown this up. This is the outer mitochondrial membrane. This is the inner mitochondrial membrane. And it's thought that you have a translocon-like structure in each of them. And that it is possible, in this case, to unfold a protein, wiggle it through the pore, and fold it on the other side. Now, some proteins which belong in the space between the two membranes are thought to pass through one translocon and take up residence. Other proteins are thought to go all the way through into the matrix. What about proteins that belong in the membrane? As with proteins that enter the ER, they might get halfway through and then lodge by a stop transfer sequence and slide out. On the other hand, it's thought that some of the proteins, at least of the inner membrane, get there by going first to the matrix and then entering the membrane from the inside. But now, how could most of the proteins of the matrix are thought to go all the way across? They wiggle through one translocon in the outer membrane and then in the inner. And the reason that works well is that these two translocons are thought to be located right next to each other, making what amounts to a continuous passage. And if you look at pictures of mitochondria, you see spots where the inner membrane is very close to the outer membrane. This is called a contact point. And the assumption is that at that point, the two sets of translocons are aligned. And this is where proteins enter that are going to go into the matrix, because they wiggle across through both of the joined translocons. Now, to get into the matrix, you have to have some kind of localization signal. Remember, you needed one to get into the nucleus, you needed one to get into a peroxisome. The localization signal that allows this protein to go through the translocons is usually on the amino end, and it's usually called a transit peptide. Some people use the term signal peptide to mean localization signal. But we're going to try to be careful and use signal peptide only to mean the kind that says take me to the ER, and everything else is called something else. So this is called a transit peptide, and it's known that it is removed after the protein starts to get in. And it's not clear why that is, but one possibility is that keeps the protein from leaving. And another possibility is that when you take off the transit peptide, you will in fact uncover additional sequences which say additional things, because there's more than one place to end up here. Take me to a mitochondrion is not sufficient. Is it take me to the matrix, take me to the inner membrane, take me to the intramembrane space, or take me to the outer membrane? Which is it? So it's conceivable that some proteins enter the matrix, you take off the transit peptide, and then the next sequence is what allows entry, say, into the inner membrane, just the same way proteins get into the ER. Now, as you might expect, to get into a mitochondrion, to get in anywhere after you've been made, requires energy. So where's the energy going to come from? Well, you know that mitochondria usually have a lot of ATP. They make ATP. But they also have another form of energy which can be used to get the new chains in. And that's that normally, remember, they have a proton gradient because they've been pumping protons as the result of electron transport. So normally there's a proton gradient with more proteins here than over here. Across this membrane, there is a proton gradient. And a gradient, like with secondary active transport, is in fact a form of energy that can be used to move things. So as long as either there is ATP inside or there is a proton gradient across the inner membrane, you can move in proteins. Now, we mentioned chaperones already. In this case, we're pretty sure that the protein unfolds. Or better yet, when the protein is made on free ribosomes in the cytoplasm, it stays unfolded, which means it's associated with a chaperone when it's made. So the protein is made on free ribosomes, and then it associates with a chaperone, which probably keeps it from folding and helps get it to the surface of the mitochondrion. Then there's another chaperone inside here. This is a mitochondrial chaperone. And it binds to the protein once it gets inside and helps it fold up. People also think that binding to the chaperone has some of the effect of rolling up the protein or reeling it in and helping it move into the mitochondrial matrix. So there are at least two types of chaperones needed here to make this work. One in the cytoplasm to keep the protein ready to go, and one in the mitochondrion to fold it up properly once it gets inside. Now, I think we've covered most of the important features of mitochondria and chloroplasts and how things get moved, their respective proteins get to where they're supposed to go and what they do. We haven't talked about what mitochondria do because that was discussed last semester. So maybe to wrap this up, let me ask you a question or two and then you can ask Nisa. Now we have here a great innovation which was inspired by Dr. Heiklin, who noticed that I was too short to get down the tall board, and as a result there was a shadow, and she came up with the idea of asking them to put in some kind of rope. So she doesn't need it, but I do. So we've talked about how proteins get to various places, and we've also talked at various times about genetic diseases where one protein is missing or not working. And I want to consider, what can you do about that, short of prenatal diagnosis? That is, various means of prevention. Well, consider PKU or a CF, cystic fibrosis. In the case of PKU, you're missing the enzyme phenylalanine hydroxylase, which is, I believe, a cytoplasmic enzyme, although it might be on the surface of the ER. In cystic fibrosis, you're missing a transporter. It's a membrane-embedded transmembrane protein, which is responsible for moving chloride. In Gaucher's disease, which we mentioned last time, you're missing one of the lysosomal enzymes. And in Tay-Sachs disease, you're missing a different one. And if you're a diabetic, you don't make a type 1, you don't have any insulin. And maybe we'll put in, you could be missing, growth hormone. A person who doesn't make enough growth hormone is unusually short, and I'm not sure what the right politically correct name for it at the moment, whether it's midget or dwarf. But they don't grow to normal height. They're in the right proportions, but they don't grow to normal height. And these are lysosomal enzymes. There are also people missing peroxisomal enzymes, and there are people missing mitochondrial enzymes. So the question is, what can you do? And the obvious thing is to supply the missing enzyme. And I have a question, in which of these cases can you supply the missing enzyme and get success? Perhaps I should say protein, because these two are not enzymes, but they're proteins. So just think about it for a minute. Which of these will it work? So you can talk about it for a minute. Let's think, which of those will it work?
Thank you.
fairly complicated question, so maybe we'll just go through some of it. Can you add this enzyme back? Well, the answer is you can't. And the reason is, what happens if you were to add a protein to the outside of a cell? Well, if it got inside, presumably it would be endocytosis, right? And it would be inside a membrane. So where would it end up? Somewhere in the endomembrane system, probably in lysosomes, and it would probably get degraded. It certainly wouldn't end up in the cytoplasm. For this protein to work, it has to get in intact, and it doesn't. It gets degraded. Now, this one also is supposed to work as part of a membrane. And there's no way an added protein can get properly inserted into a membrane. Again, if it gets into the cell, it's going to be engulfed in a vesicle. And these are both, presumably, going to be destroyed in lysosomes. And this is the case for most missing enzymes. If you add them, they just get degraded. They either don't get taken up by the cell at all, and if they do, they get degraded. What about this one? We actually talked about this one last time. This is the most famous example, probably, of enzyme replacement therapy. You can add this enzyme, and it will be taken up by cells that lack it and end up in the right place. But why? By the scavenger pathway, because it's supposed to be in a lysosome. So if this one gets taken up and put into a lysosome, you're okay. And the trick is being sure it has mannose-6-phosphate on it, so it's taken up by receptor-mediated endocytosis and goes to the right place. Now, Tay-Sachs is also caused by a lack of a lysosomal enzyme. It's also a lysosomal storage disease. But enzyme therapy doesn't, replacement therapy doesn't work. Why not? Well, the answer to that is that in Gaucher's, the cells that are largely messed up are macrophages. And in the case of Tay-Sachs, it's brain cells. So macrophages can take up enzyme from the blood, and the brain cells cannot. Remember the blood-brain barrier. Material in the blood cannot get access to the cells of the brain. Now, what about these? I'm sure you all know that diabetics take insulin. And why does it work? You add proteins, they get degraded, kaput. What's different about insulin? Insulin is not an enzyme. Insulin is a hormone or a signal molecule. It's an endocrine. Now, we talked about paracrines and endocrines last time. What are they supposed to do? They're secreted by one cell type, and they bind to receptors on another cell type. So they normally travel through the blood. So you can inject them into the blood, and you're okay. That's why usually most people who take insulin have to get shots. People have been trying to develop oral insulin, but so far I don't think it's terribly successful. But if you inject insulin into the bloodstream, it goes to where it's supposed to go and does what it's supposed to do. Now, what about growth hormone? Well, by calling it a hormone, you imply it's an endocrine. So that implies that it also is something that travels through the bloodstream. And if you inject it into the bloodstream, the person will, in fact, it will do what it's supposed to do, and the person will grow to more or less normal height, which is indeed true. Now, can you add a peroxisomal enzyme? When you think about these, most of the enzymes get inserted after they're made, right? So why can't you add them? You'd have to inject it, the protein into the cell, and nobody knows how to do that. Now, what about gene therapy? People think eventually gene therapy will be able to fix all of these, that you'll put a good copy of the gene into the appropriate cell, it will make the appropriate protein, and it'll get where it's supposed to go. Now, it seems to me there's one case you can't fix with gene therapy. There are two kinds of mitochondrial enzymes. Those that are encoded in the mitochondrial DNA and those that are encoded in the nucleus. Does it make any difference?
Yes.
If you added a gene to a cell that coded for a protein normally made in the cytoplasm, you should be okay. The gene will be transcribed, you'll make the message, the ribosomes will read it, and you'll make the protein. And then the protein will be inserted into the mitochondria like it's supposed to be. But what if the protein was supposed to be made in the mitochondria in the first place? Then you have to do mitochondrial gene therapy. You would somehow have to figure out how to get your gene into mitochondria, or it wouldn't work. So it seems to me this is probably the biggest challenge. But I should mention one other thing that people have tried before I go on, which is largely has to do with these. In addition to trying to replace the enzyme, or ideally someday the gene for the enzyme in these storage diseases, in some of these cases, what people have done is to try and use drugs that cut down the production of whatever it is the enzyme is supposed to degrade. This is called substrate reduction therapy. Or SRT. That the trouble in Tay-Sachs disease is that a complex lipid, which is made in neurons, builds up and can't be degraded. Now, you can't do without it, and you can't stop it from being made. But if you can cut down on the amount that's made, on the turnover, then there would be less garbage piling up and less of a problem. And this has been tried for Gaucher's disease in people who you couldn't do replacement therapy on. And I don't know if it has been tried for Tay-Sachs or whether it works. But this is another approach to a lack of a degrading enzyme, is to cut down on the substrate which it is supposed to degrade. Now, one of the reasons for bringing these two up is that these are signal molecules. And what I want to talk about next is how signal molecules work. How is it that having these floating around in the bloodstream causes anything to happen? So let me ask before I do that if there are questions about the protein sorting and the organelles. Yes?
Do enzymes
have to be injected? I think this one, no. Maybe it does. I think this one may be an infusion, but I'm not sure. I don't know how you get that one. Yeah?
If you were to do gene therapy on a type 1 diabetic, would that work if the diabetes is causing an autoimmune reaction?
His question is that if the cells that make insulin have been destroyed by an autoimmune reaction, then replacing the gene might not work, because if you replace the gene, the cells in which it's active would also be destroyed. That's possible. Yep.
How do you get the genes inside the cells?
How do you get the genes inside the cells? Well, that's what people don't know how to do. That's why this is all theoretical. The getting genes inside cells is done in some cases by putting the genes into modified viruses. That's the most common way of doing it. Or putting them in small lipid-bound vesicles. And either of those will, under the right circumstances, feud with cells and deliver the goods. But the biggest problem with gene therapy has been finding a way to both target the genes to the necessary cells and then to get the gene into the cells in a form in which it will be properly regulated, in which it will be turned on and off when it's supposed to, and it will not interrupt or interfere with the operation of other genes, none of which is trivial. Yeah. With what? Is substrate reduction therapy with PKU? Well, I think not. And in a way, with PKU, the problem is that you can't convert phenylalanine to tyrosine. And in a way, the modified diet is a form of substrate reduction therapy, in that you have to provide, you have to have all 20 amino acids, as we mentioned last year, or you're dead. But you want to be sure that there's none left over for this enzyme to have to work on. So in a way, that is what it is. Yeah?
Is it generally safe to safe assumption that things that function as paracrines, like growth hormones, can be fixed by injection into the bloodstream?
Is it correct that things like paracrines, you really meant endocrines, I think, can be fixed by injection into the bloodstream? Many of them, yes. One of the problems is that in many times, endocrines, or general signal molecules, are often regulated in a very complicated way, so that you make just the right amount of signal at just the right amount of time. And so replacing the signal is certainly better than no signal, but replacing the signal in a way that mimics the natural is difficult. And that's been the problem with insulin and diabetics, that delivering insulin, not too much, not too little, just the right times, has been very hard to artificially to set up. One more.
Are there different types of transit peptides?
Are there different types of transit peptides? Usually, when you say transit peptide, you mean that targets the protein to the matrix. Now, there may be a different sequence that targets the protein to the outer membrane or the intramembrane space or even the inner membrane. Okay. Now, I want to switch gears and talk about signaling. And I don't know if I need to convince you what you need signaling for. We've talked about that many times. That in a multicellular organism, obviously you have to coordinate what is going on. And that's really what you need signaling for. Both you need it during development, and in a functioning adult organism, you need it to keep everything coordinated. That the usual way signaling works, at least in outline, is that one cell secretes a molecule, which then binds to receptors on or in another cell. Sometimes it binds to receptors on itself, but usually to another cell. Now, when we talked about it last time, we classified signals by the type of cell it made it and how far it had to go. So we talked about endocrines, paracrines, neuroendocrines, juxtacrines, all that stuff. But there are other ways to classify signal molecules which are useful. And one is by their chemical nature. So I want to talk today more about that. In order to explain how they work, to actually get an effect, you have to consider their chemical properties. So you want to now look at A, which is the Big Bang theory of signaling. But to start, you want to look at the bottom. Where it says signals. From the point of view of chemical nature, there are actually two major kinds of signals. There are water-soluble signals, and there are lipid-soluble signals. And these are generated and handled very differently. So we're going to talk about them, as you'll see, separately. Now, one way of looking at it is what kind of receptor do they need? You notice that the next column says receptors. If a signal molecule is lipid-soluble, then it can cross a membrane and enter the cytoplasm of the cell and bind to a receptor in the cytoplasm or nucleus of the cell. So in this case, the receptor is going to be intracellular. And as we will see, it is almost always a transcription factor. In the case of water-soluble signals, though, they cannot get into their target cells. So they have to bind to receptors that are transmembrane proteins and that stick out and have an extracellular domain. So the receptors have to be on the cell surface, and they have to be transmembrane. Now, sometimes people call these extracellular receptors. They're not. They're on the surface of the cell. If this is the inside and this is the outside, where is the signal molecule? The signal molecule has to be outside. So there has to be a domain, an extracellular domain, for binding the signal molecule. But the receptor itself is not extracellular. It only has an extracellular domain. It has to have actually a transmembrane domain to anchor it and a cytoplasmic domain so that when it binds its ligand, there'll be a change inside the cell. And that's the whole idea here, that the signal stays on the outside. The signal molecule ligand stays on the outside, but the signal is conveyed to the inside. And one of the big questions we're going to ask is, how is that done? Now, there's several different kinds of cell surface receptors mentioned here. We're going to leave that for now and come back to it. What we want to consider now is this big divide between the water-soluble and the lipid-soluble. And we want to consider first, how are these signals released? If you have a lipid-soluble signal molecule and a cell makes it, what then? Where is it going to go? Can you hold on to it? Remember, a lipid-soluble molecule can pass a membrane. So once you make a lipid-soluble signal, you can't hold on to it. On the other hand, what about a water-soluble signal? How do you think those are usually made? Now, you can cheat and look at the top of your handout. Because on the top of the handout, we've outlined what happens with the two kinds of signals and the corresponding receptors. So here we have a cell at the upper left, which is making two kinds of signals. And in this case, the signal that I used here, this is meant to be the lipid-soluble one, so I should have used a different symbol over there. And then this is meant to be the water-soluble signal. Now, water-soluble signals can be large molecules. They can be proteins like insulin. Or they can be small molecules like a thyroid hormone, thyroxine, or steroids. But either way, they're water-soluble and they're put into a vesicle. So, how do you release the lipid-soluble signal? Well, you sort of don't. You make it, and it just diffuses out of the cell and into its target cell. So you see we have the target cell over here. Its receptor is inside. Now, how does this molecule get through the blood to its target? If it's lipid-soluble, it can get across a membrane, but it can't float around in the blood. So all these lipid-soluble signals have carrier proteins. They have proteins that bind to them, and the combination goes through the blood. So it goes with a carrier protein. And then once it gets inside a cell, you get the same picture we drew over there. That once the ligand binds its receptor, the receptor changes conformation. Now, this is a critical thing. The idea that a receptor binds its ligand and changes conformation is true of cell surface receptors, and it's true of intracellular receptors. It's the critical thing. And it's this change in conformation that's going to trigger some action in the target cell. All right. So we see what's happened. This is an intracellular receptor, and as we said, it's a transcription factor, almost always. Now, what about if you have a water-soluble signal, like insulin, epinephrine? What's it going to do? How are you going to get this released from the cell? What's going to happen to release this to the outside? This is one of those secretory vesicles we talked about. And it's going to fuse with the plasma membrane. Some signal is going to trigger a calcium spike, and you're going to have exocytosis. So you notice that you have this picture here. that by exocytosis, you're going to release your water-soluble signal. Now, it can travel through the blood. It may have a carrier protein, but doesn't need one. It can travel by itself. It's water-soluble. And when it gets to its receptor is going to have to be on the cell surface, as we've explained. And when it binds the ligand, we're going to have a change again in the cytoplasmic domain. But the ligand, notice, remains on the outside. Now, the ligand may be taken in by endocytosis and destroyed in lysosomes. Or it may just stay on the outside. Once the ligand has bound and the receptor has changed conformation, we don't really need the ligand anymore. The ligand has sent the word, and that's it. Now, we see here then the way you release a signal molecule is simply it diffuses out or you have exocytosis depending on if it's water-soluble or lipid-soluble. And then it binds to its receptor and the receptor changes conformation. And then what? You notice this is called the Big Bang Theory. And the reason it's called the Big Bang Theory is because a few molecules of signal produce a big result in the target cell. There is a huge amount of amplification in this system that only takes one of these, actually, to get a response of many things happening in the cell. It may be, I shouldn't say many different things, it may only be one thing. But if this leads, say, to modification of an enzyme, you may modify many, many copies of that enzyme. And if it leads to synthesis of a new enzyme, you may make many, many copies of that enzyme. Now, the real question is, how do you get the big bang for your buck? What is the amplification system here that is responsible for getting you a big result? The most famous example is that it's calculated in Becker that one molecule of epinephrine bound to the right cell, and epinephrine is one of these, one molecule of epinephrine bound to the right cell will cause the release of 10 to the 8 molecules of glucose from glycogen. Now, if you read Sadov, it's only 10 to the 4. But the truth is, it's some enormous number. And the question is, how can one crummy molecule of signal cause you to break down so much glycogen to release tens of thousands of molecules? So on the bottom of this handout, or I should say in the middle, there are the three basic methods of amplification. We want to look at those. Methods are, one of them has to do with ion channels. One has to do with what says here, second messenger. I'll explain what that is. And one involves the nucleus. Now, the basic idea is either we're going to open some ion channels, or we're going to cause a modification cascade, or we're going to trigger transcription. Now, let me explain what these are and why it makes a big difference. So what's this ion channel business? What the signal can do, directly or indirectly, is it can bind to and open an ion channel. Now, what kind of ion channel is this? We said that ion channels are gated, that they're opened and closed by a mechanical means, a chemical means, electrical. What's happening here? Well, it's the binding of this ligand, or something derived from it, binds to this channel. So this is a ligand-gated channel, or a chemically-gated channel, and it opens, or closes, but the simple case, it opens. So it's a ligand-gated channel, as it says on your handout. This allows ions to move. And depending on which ion it is and what kind of channel and what the setup is, maybe they'll move in, maybe they'll move out. But they're going to change the potential across this membrane. They're going to change the charge distribution or the voltage or the potential across this membrane. Now, if you change it enough, and in this case, with nerves, you often depolarize. You make it less minus on the inside relative to the outside. But what can that do when you change the potential? You can now open voltage-gated channels. So the change in the potential causes the opening or closing of voltage-gated channels. Now, the critical thing here is you own, with your chemical, you only opened a few channels. You only let a few ions move. But those few ions made a big difference in potential, and that allows you to open a whole bunch of channels. And that means lots and lots of ions move. You make a huge difference in potential, and something happens. And you get a big effect. Now, this is the kind of mechanism responsible for most muscle movement, for nerve conduction, for your responding to light, to sound, etc. And Dr. Feierstein will talk about how this works in detail later. So we're going to put this aside, but this is a very important deal. So one kind of amplification is ligand-gated channels change the voltage, which opens voltage-gated channels, bam. Now, the second messenger business, I'm going to cheat and I'm just going to put this in a box, which we will come back to, the proverbial black box. The critical point here is that directly or indirectly, you generate a modification cascade. That's really the important part here. We'll come back to the second messenger business. Now, what do we mean by a modification cascade? In a way, you want to compare it to what goes on over here. That when you want to get more action, you can either activate the proteins you've already got, or you can make more protein. And that's what these two different cases are. A modification cascade, you don't make any new proteins, but you alter the proteins that are already there so they work better or worse. While with transcription factor activation, you make new messages, new proteins, and more proteins. So let's come back to our modification cascade. Now, the business I said with epinephrine is an example of this. If you activate one molecule of an enzyme, which has as its substrate other proteins, let's say it's a protein kinase, then it adds phosphates to other enzymes. So you've got one active molecule of enzyme, and it adds phosphate to, say, 100 molecules of protein. So now you have 100 molecules, let's say activated, could be inactivated, but let's say activated. Now each of those 100 is a kinase, and it goes and it modifies another 100. So now you've got 100 times 100 already. So what we're saying is the way these work is enzyme number one modifies a bunch of other enzymes, and then each of those modifies a bunch of other enzymes, and you can have multiple steps from 2, I think the longest one is 5. But you can have quite a long sequence, and that's how you get this enormous multiplication of 10 to the 4 or 10 to the 8. Now, we'll talk about some real examples of this. But the net effect is the target protein at the end, many, many molecules of it are either activated or inactivated. So you change enzyme activity of some target, and the net result is you get a big effect. Epinephrine, by a series of modifications, eventually modifies the enzyme and activates the enzyme that breaks down glycogen. Glycogen, remember, is glucose, 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 glucose. It's a storage form of glucose, and this enzyme breaks it down into glucose-1-phosphate. And that can be shuttled into glycolysis, and you can get energy. So one molecule of epinephrine through a modification cascade causes you to activate thousands of molecules of glycogen phosphorylase, which then generate umpteen molecules of glucose. Now, another example of this, which is given in your handout, I think, in your notes somewhere, is thyroid-stimulating hormone, which also triggers a series of modifications, so that the enzymes that make thyroid hormone are activated, and they pour out thyroid hormone. It turns out that case is more simple, but the basic idea is the same. Now, the final way you're getting amplification is not modifying the enzymes you already have, but making new enzymes. Now, why is that an amplification? Remember that if you have some transcription factors and you change gene activity, now you can make, we'll consider turn on, but it works for a turn off too. Now you can make lots of message from that one gene, and then protein from that mRNA. But why is this an amplification device? Because from one copy of the gene, you make many copies of the message, and from each copy of the message, you have many ribosomes, and you make many copies of the protein. So you get a lot of your target protein by activating one gene. So this is three ways you can get a big effect. One is with channels, one is with modification cascades, and one is from synthesis of new protein. So what I think we'll do to wrap it up today is we're going to talk a little bit about how this one works. We're going to put off the channel business till Dr. Feierstein comes, and we're going to talk actually most of the time in this class, in the, after break, about how this one works and what a second messenger is and so on. But I want to talk very briefly about how this kind of amplification deal works. Because in these cases, we've said the actual intracellular receptor is itself a transcription factor. And all the transcription factors that respond to hormones come from the same family, and they work in pretty much the same way. So these are receptor transcription factors. Now, not all receptors are the same, not all transcription factors are the same. But all the transcription factor receptors come from the same gene family, and the proteins have at least three domains. This is the conventional way, amino on the end, carboxyl on the left. And they have a section in the middle that binds to DNA. So that's called the DNA binding domain, because a transcription factor has to bind to DNA or can't do anything. Now, these transcription factors change conformation when they bind their ligand or hormone. So one of the domains has to bind the hormone. And this is the ligand binding domain. So in our picture, that would be this one. Except these are intracellular. So it would be on the right there. Now, once they stick to the DNA and bind their ligand, they affect transcription. They either inhibit transcription or they activate transcription, and they do that by binding to the other parts of the transcription machine, to DNA polymerase, to other transcription factors, to cofactors, the works that Dr. Heitland talked about. And this is the part responsible for activating or inhibiting transcription. Now, what's this thing? Is it a transacting factor or a cisacting factor? This goes and sits on the DNA. So it's a transacting factor, and this is often called the transacting domain. If it's an activator, it's called the transcription activating domain. If it's an inhibitor, it's called the transaction inhibiting domain, but it's the transacting domain. And this goes, and now where's the cis part? Here's the DNA. Here's the beginning of transcription. Usually, somewhere here, near where the basal or core promoter is, there is a series of sections called hormone response elements. So if this is the thyroid hormone response element, then the receptor for thyroid hormone binds here. If this is the estrogen response element, the transcription factor receptor that binds estrogen binds here. So what happens, how do you actually get any action here, is that When the ligand comes along, and these steps are written out in your notes, when the hormone or the ligand comes along, it binds to the transcription factor. And usually when the transcription factor is lying around doing nothing, it's associated with some sort of inhibitory protein, and that comes off. So something has been keeping this quiet, and it comes off. Remember, an inhibition of an inhibition is an activation. So the hormone comes along and binds, kicking off any inhibitor proteins. And then these things normally have to dimerize in order to do anything. And then they have to bind to the right place on the DNA. Now, some of these reside in the cytoplasm waiting for their hormone. And some of them reside in the nucleus waiting for their hormone. But once the hormone arrives, if they're in the cytoplasm, they go to the nucleus. So let me say, there has to be at least one more domain in here already that I can think about. Has to be some signal in here. Where does this thing work? Works in the nucleus, right? So in addition to everything that I've said, it has to have an NLS. It has to have an NLS, and it also has some section that allows it to dimerize, or a dimerization domain. So it has those two. So it dimerizes if it's in the cytoplasm, it moves to the nucleus, and then it finds the right site, cis site, on the DNA, and you get some action. You affect transcription, either to inhibit or activate. Now we have an example in your notes, but it's getting late, so I think we'll stop here and talk about the example next time. But you want to think about something very important. How come when the same hormone binds to the same receptor, the cell doesn't always respond the same way? Because in response to estrogen, the uterus does one thing and the breast does something else. And so we'll discuss why that is. There are many extra TA office hours because of the exam, and they're all listed on the website. Well, they're considered depending on how you classify. They're either considered part of the basal promoter or proximal. I would call them proximal regulatory elements. Exactly.
Why is the transacting domain? Why don't that different from the?
Why do you have?
Why is it different than the sexual device of the DNA?
Oh, because this sticks to the DNA, and then this sticks to the rest, to the other transcription factors and POAC factors and stuff. Okay, so you can mix and match this part and this part.
Essentially, they don't do the same thing.
No, they're not. One of them is walking on the floor, and one of them is holding the water.
Right, right.
Okay, so you can say all together, yeah, they're doing the same thing.
The complex is like
the complex, but the point is that the part that allows me to walk on the floor is my feet, and the part that allows me to do this is my hands, and there you could say they're different.
One other thing. The lipid soluble signals that are going to the blood attached to a protein that they have to.